Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this podcast episode, we call this place the Great Northwest, and Ampersand Magazine is dedicated to keeping it that way. They gave voice to some of the greatness around us at a recent live event.
There are 5,000 salmon spawning streams in the Tongass National Forest, and how each fish finds its way back to the exact stream where it was born has got to be one of the greatest feats of nature.
Ampersand is an offshoot of Forterra, a conservation organization that seeks to celebrate where we are and where we're going, with a focus on community-built solutions and creativity. This Ampersand Live event, their third annual, took place at Town Hall Seattle on November 10th. Thank you to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You'll find the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum.
I'm Gene Duvernoy, president of Forterra. We host this event. Now, before we start, I want to acknowledge the political earthquake that has really shaken our country. Acknowledge it, yes, but also claim this evening for the Pacific Northwest community.
Yeah.
Man, you guys are going to be a good crowd. So tonight, we are going to bring you perspectives from people all across the Pacific Northwest about the resiliency of this place and us, and about how together we care for ourselves and this place. We believe these stories need to be told now more than ever. This election has really brought home how deeply divided this country is. But here in the Pacific Northwest, we still know how to get together and find common ground and come together. So thank you for being part of that. Now let's start Ampersand Live.
Hi. My name is David Schmader. Hello! God damn it. We're not going to get into that. I just want to do one thing. Okay, everyone, I need you to do this thing for me. Please stand. If you're unable to stand, stand in your heart. Take the hand of the person next to you, both sides, and I'm just going to do a roll call. We can't do everyone individually. We just want to do en masse. When I say Seattle, you say here. Seattle?
Here.
Thank you. That's all I needed. All right. Hi. So I'm a writer and performer and a movie maker, funner of her, and I have lived in this region for 25 years. Long enough to have heard several distinct cycles of complaints that Seattle's losing its soul. Smart people will say conclusively, Seattle lost its soul. And whenever I hear someone say this, I want to say, what the hell are you talking about? And that's led me to ask myself, what the hell are people talking about? And I figure a good first step in determining is figuring out what you mean when you say a soul of a city. And the best answer that I've been able to come up with is that the soul of the city is what you first loved about a place, or the city as it was when you first fell in love with it. I moved here in 1991, and for me, the soul of Seattle existed primarily in a four-block radius of Broadway on Capitol Hill, which not only held the lesbian-owned independent bookstore where I worked, but also my favorite independent record store, Orpheum, and my first favorite Thai restaurant, Siam, and the gorgeous art house cinema, The Harvard Exit. I was from far west Texas. I was amazed to live someplace where they sold pizza by the slice. I was like, cosmopolitan! It was everything I needed all in one place. And of course, this utopia resided within the larger utopia of the natural world. And the fact that I could exit the progressive lesbian bookstore and make a 15-minute drive to watch a sunset at Golden Gardens was key to what I considered the soul of the city. All of the establishments I just mentioned that made me love Seattle are now gone, as is the possibility of making a 15-minute drive from Capitol Hill to Golden Gardens. But the soul of the city lives on for me in a zillion other ways. Seattle continues to offer top-flight culture and progressive humanity and now legal weed, while surrounded by glorious natural experiences on all sides. It may not be exactly what I fell in love with, but it is all still here, and every new arrival finds their own soul of the city. And tonight we will celebrate this soul by giving voice to a slew of people who fuel it and sustain it and enjoy it. Thank you so much for coming. Let's get started.
Hello, it's a real honor to be here with you tonight. My name's John Grotti, and I'm going to very briefly share a project with you, a sculptural project that was inspired by a desire to begin by casting a live tree. And I went into the forest near the middle fork of the Snoqualmie River to find that tree. And I was looking for a tree that felt sort of typical. I wanted it to be a fairly mature tree, but I wasn't looking for a tree that was unusual and sort of romantic. And had the option of potentially making a digital scan of this tree, which would have taken 2 hours, but much more impractically, decided to do a plaster cast of the tree. Fortunately, I had a gang of help to embark upon this very impractical venture. It took about 2 weeks for a dozen of us to slowly cast this tree. So you can see we were protecting the tree and with a thick foil and laying these layers of plaster on the tree. When I sort of cooked up this idea of being up and hanging in this tree, I was imagining these sort of intimate moments of getting to know the tree, but we've got a drone flying around us, so it's a little bit of a circus, and I didn't quite have that level of kind of reflective quality, but I did get to know certain nuances of the tree. And it was an important thing for me to think about how I could share that experience with other people. One of the things that I find most compelling about projects is how to get other people to engage with me, especially this sort of large-scale project. What we're seeing here are the molds that we took of this tree brought back to an institution that's new to Seattle, relatively speaking, called Mad Art Studios. This is looking at the outside of the space. It's a terrific place. This was the inaugural project for this space, and what we did is we opened up these large doors, these glass doors, and invited people just happening to pass by to participate in making the project. And in order to do that, what we decided to make was this thin skin of wood using reclaimed cedar. And we built this very intricate skin over this mold of the tree. And the skin of this tree is made by all of these small individual blocks. So a person is given a small pallet of these blocks. They choose each of these pieces, and with the greatest fidelity they can muster, they try to keep a sense of that mold. So they're really understanding a small nuance of the tree. It's a very slow process. So you might get done in 4 hours an area about this big. Over the past 2 years, this project's been going on. There have been more than 1,000 people helping to work on the project. We showed the project when the tree form had become about 40 feet long in the same space in which we made it. And then we took the piece on the road to the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. This is a bit of video showing what happens after all of the different people are contributing by building and gluing these blocks together. And it's a kind of a refining. And the challenge with this was to not take away too much of the individual nuance, because the people working on this project all kind of go their own way. You have a sort of a set direction that you're hoping people will take. But you'll find as you look at the piece, this is the images of the piece as it was installed in the Smithsonian. So we're seeing it at about 50 feet in length here. Each time it goes to a new venue, it's growing. The piece will be shown at the Seattle Art Museum in about 2.5 months. And when it gets to the Seattle Art Museum and in the entry to the museum, it will be about 105 feet long. And at that point, there will probably be close to 1 million of these individual pieces that we've put together. Thank you. And I will close here just so you have a sense of moving through the piece a little bit. This is looking through the wide end, so you're about 10 feet across. And I'll close with this video. The one thing I also want to mention is it will continue to go to a number of other venues and sort of represent our region in a small way. But after it's done being shown at a number of these different locations, we're going to take the sculpture back to the living tree that it was cast from, lay it on the forest floor, and let it moss over and slowly disintegrate into the ground. Thank you.
Next up, photographer Amy Gullick is the author of Salmon in the Trees, Life in Alaska's Tongass Rainforest.
Curiosity. Curiosity drives me to get out of bed every day. It also drives people mad with my endless questions of why things are the way they are. Why is the sky blue? Why are no two snowflakes ever the same? And why are there salmon in trees? It is this last question I spent several years of my life pursuing. At the start, all I knew was that I needed to go to Alaska, a mind-boggling state in its enormity. The part I needed to go to? The rainforest of Alaska. Not typically what comes to mind when we think of the 49th state. Most of this rainforest is in southeast Alaska, also known as the Inside Passage, or the panhandle of the state. 80% of southeast, everything you see in green, is the Tongass National Forest. With 17 million acres, about the size of the state of West Virginia, the Tongass is our country's largest national forest, and it's home to one-third of the world's remaining old-growth coastal temperate rainforest. This is a place where the line is blurred between where the forest ends and the sea begins. So you'll see things here like bears digging for clams on the beaches. Humpback whales cruise right along the forested shorelines, and marbled murrelets, a seabird that nests high in old-growth forests and feeds in the ocean. The Tongass is home to one of the highest densities of brown bears in the world, the highest density of black bears, and the world's largest nesting density of bald eagles. Why so many? Well, there's an abundance of food, particularly salmon. Salmon are born in freshwater streams and rivers. They head out to the oceans to mature, and then they return to their birth streams as adults to spawn the next generation. There are 5,000 salmon spawning streams in the Tongass National Forest, and how each fish finds its way back to the exact stream where it was born has got to be one of the greatest feats of nature. Salmon help grow at least 50 different species, among them bears, stellar sea lions, and Homo sapiens. Salmon help grow the native cultures that have thrived along these forested shores since time immemorial. Salmon grow the local communities. The commercial salmon fishery in Alaska is one of the world's best examples of a sustainable fishery, and it's a critical part of the economy. Salmon also help grow trees. In fact, they are in the trees. Well, how can this be? Well, bears have a lot to do with this. Bears don't like being around other bears, so when they catch a fish, they will often carry it away from the stream and into the woods. Researchers say that one bear can carry 40 fish from a stream in just 8 hours. So let's think about this for a minute. There's 5,000 spawning streams, some of the world's highest densities of both brown and black bears, and millions of wild salmon. You do the math. That adds up to a lot of salmon dragged and dropped into the forest. Other animals scavenge on these carcasses, spreading the nutrients farther throughout the forest. Well, guess what happens? All of this rich fish fertilizer decomposes into the soil, and the trees and other vegetation absorb it through their roots. Scientists have actually been able to trace a particular form of marine nitrogen. It comes from the ocean. It's called nitrogen 15. They've been able to trace this in trees near spawning streams that it's brought by salmon, delivered by bears, and absorbed by plants. That is how salmon end up in the trees. And the trees return the favor by shading the streams, creating protected pools, and feeding insects that then feed the young salmon. So once you understand this remarkable connection between salmon and trees, you quickly see that everything here is still connected. It's astounding in the 21st century. This connection between salmon and trees resulted in my first book, and thanks to Elliott Bay Books, it is out in the lobby. It also really, really opened my eyes to my own home here in the Pacific Northwest. North America's original coastal temperate rainforest, once extended intact all the way from South Central Alaska through the Pacific Northwest and down into Northern California. Today, about 44% has been affected by urban development, logging, or farming. So anywhere where you see in red, those original forests are gone. But wait, you ask, we have forests and salmon here, right? Yes, we do, but we have less than 10% of our old-growth forests and historical salmon runs. But we eat salmon here, right? Yes, we do. We love it here. But most wild salmon that we consume here are coming from Alaska. Now, I don't point this out. I don't point this out to bum you out. I've spent a lot of time going back and forth between here and Southeast Alaska. The similarities are striking. But so are the differences. Flying north, I'm hurled back to what Washington once was just a mere 150 years ago, a thriving, intact ecosystem. Coming home, I'm thrust back into what could be the future of the Tongass, given enough time. It's why I made the book. There's still time to not make the same mistakes in Alaska that we did here. But what about here? Are we out of time? I don't think so. Will we ever get it all back? I don't think so. But I also didn't think that in my lifetime in our beloved Northwest that we'd see the day when the Elwha Dams on the Olympic Peninsula came crashing down. And salmon returning home to that beautiful river as it rewilds itself. The Elwha Dam removal has opened up the very real possibilities of removing other significant barriers to salmon recovery. Can we do this here? I think so. Can the Northwest once again be a place where there are salmon in the trees? Thank you.
Up next at Ampersand Live, biologist, author, and Guggenheim Fellow, Thor Hansen.
They always put the short guy after the tall people. Thank you. I brought with me tonight the skull of a beaver, cleaned to museum quality by the larvae of dermestid beetles. This is really great. If you have a dirty old skull of any kind that you need to clean up, you put it in a bucket full of these little flesh-eating larvae, and they just clean it right up like this for free. It's fantastic. So I highly recommend those dermestid larvae if you have any skulls you need to clean. Now, we're going to come back to that skull in a minute. But first, I have to tell you that I have been experiencing what can only be called career whiplash. I don't know if you've had this experience, but when your job starts changing so fast, it kind of makes your head spin. Now, I trained as a biologist, you know, the sort of person concerned with these maggot and skull questions. But my interest in the storytelling of science led me to start writing books about natural history. Okay, fair enough. But recently, this thing has taken a turn that I never saw coming. It all started a few years ago when my wife and I had a child, which, as any parent will tell you, is a lot more than just getting a new roommate. You know, children change the story of your life, and if you are a storyteller, well, then they change the stories that you tell. In fact, they even change the words that you use. Like a lot of parents, when Noah came into our lives, I decided that I had to clean up my language a little bit. And I thought I did a pretty good job. I settled on the word crap. I could say crap, right? It's not so bad, and it's still kind of satisfying to say it. And Noah, I mean, he thinks this is hilarious, right? He loves this word because he knows whenever he hears Papa saying crap and crap that I'm really getting worked up about something. So he and I were going fishing recently, and we were looking through the rule book for fishing, the Washington State regulations there, and they've got a page where they show pictures of all the different fish that you might be able to catch. And sure enough, there's one in there called the crappy. I looked at that. I thought, oh, man, he is going to love this. So, hey, buddy, what's that one there? Because he's learning to read, right? And he looks at it, and he can't quite make it out. He says, I don't know, Papa. And I said, oh, I think you do. It's a word that you've heard Papa say. And he looks at it again, and he says, Jesus Christ? So maybe my words haven't changed as much as I thought they had. But I do know that my writing has changed. I can assure you that it has, because my writing has begun to rhyme. My son loves rhymes, right? So it's been the most natural thing in the world for me to start writing rhyming stories for my son. And now these things have started coming out as books, and I find myself at these events where people don't know me as a scientist or even as a nature writer. They know me as a children's book author. It's all a little bit disorienting. I mean, I can't even tidy up my desk anymore without becoming really confused. I had this stack of papers the other day. I was sorting through, and I come across one that I wrote a few years ago, and the title of it was Characterization of Microsatellite Primers for a Tetraploid Rainforest Tree. You will be happy to know I'm not going to read the rest of it to you. But right next to it was something brand new with a slightly different tone. The title was Beatrice Beaver. So my career has become this unexpected mashup. But honestly, I am glad and I'm grateful for it. Because here I thought that I had been writing about nature for a wide audience, all the while missing one of the most important audiences of all, particularly important now, at a time when our children are becoming more distant from nature, spending less and less of their time outdoors. Important at a time when the Oxford Junior English Dictionary, the finest compendium of English designed for young readers, recently deleted over 40 nature words from the new edition. Words like acorn, dandelion, raven, willow, walnut, kingfisher, lark, gone. Replaced by words that better describe our increasingly indoor media and technology-focused lifestyles. So I hope that you will agree with me that in a world where bullet point just replaced buttercup in the dictionary, we all need Beatrice Beaver more than ever before. So in closing, I would like to share with you the story of Beatrice Beaver, told in rhyme, one of my son's new favorites. Beatrice Beaver briefly believed her biggest bicuspid was loose. She brushed it and flossed it and feared if she lost it, her diet would mainly be juice. Being a beaver, she was a believer that wood was the best thing to gnaw. She dreaded the thought that her teeth would all rot and food would come only by straw. But before she could scream, she awoke from her dream and laughed through the gap in her smile. Beaver bicuspids don't even exist. Their bite has a different style. With front teeth like chisels and molars to chew, a beaver chops wood like a hatchet. So she fixed up a bowl of branches and bark. For a beaver, no breakfast could match it.
I would like to speak of things Forterra does. And to do that, I have to talk about where we are in the world. Here, in this booming tech metropolis surrounded on all sides by extraordinary nature. It's an amazing situation. And Forterra works tirelessly to preserve and protect the land and places that make this region unlike any other. In its 25 years of existence, Forterra has completed more than 400 land deals, some of the newest. Saving the Wayne Golf Course to create a huge new park at the top of Lake Washington. Saving a historic farm near Tacoma and preserving city folks' access to amazing berries and pumpkins. Saving, piece by piece, a full 3,000 acres over the Kitsap Peninsula, only 30 minutes by ferry from here. On top of that, Forterra is helping with one of our region's most serious problems, the housing crisis. To this end, Forterra is going after urban land to develop, with partners, as affordable housing. That's awesome.
I'm Evan Flory Barnes. I'm a musician, composer, vocalist, songwriter, bass player, and a proud Seattleite, and wanting to bring that Seattle spirit to the world. Well, I've born and raised here in Seattle. Being born and raised here, I feel like I've seen the city go through its transitions. I can remember the city's, like, old school things, but I've also seen the city grow and expand. And what's kept me here is this feeling like there's something that can emerge out of this city in a way that nothing else can. I feel like there's an angle on nature and natural beauty, natural grandeur. I mean, if you look around, there's space for ideas to flow and exist and flourish, and there isn't this weight of an old American establishment. There is something new here that is a mixing of both this frontier spirit and this indigenous spirit and this multicultural spirit all coming together. And so I feel like there's an opportunity to create something really new that establishes this grounded but grand city. Thank you. So, the piece that I'm premiering or playing is a piece called The Way Out. And I thought it's a song that I've had in mind for a long time, and one of the first songs that I normally play in instrumental ensembles, but I'm going to be singing tonight, and I feel like going to be bringing forth singing more often as the main form of expression, along with the arranging and the composing and the songwriting, and still the bass playing. But I believe that I always like to talk about the emotional content of place, of meaning, of the emotional significance we give spaces, moments, relationships, large and small relationships to loved ones, family, friends, lovers, parents, and how that all sort of informs this memory of a city and its attachment and its clinging and its nostalgia to resistance to change and also being open to change. And so this song kind of takes a kind of abstract look at all this, and it's called The Way Out. And before I continue, I just want to thank these wonderful musicians for joining me and realizing this music in the moment. And before we continue, I'd like to dedicate this tune to my late father, who would have been 69 today, Ralph Barnes. It was his birthday. So thank you. Here we go. Thank you.
that water slide, but it's full of all the things we want to hide. Children's laughter, drunken
time to recover.
Here, filmmaker and oral historian Jill Friedberg talks about stories she gathered at the Central Area Red Apple Grocery.
So given the events of this week, it might seem a little strange to get in front of all of you and talk about a grocery store. This is my neighborhood grocery store. It's the Red Apple on 23rd and Jackson in the Central Area. And it is the place where I have witnessed the most acts of humanity than anywhere else in this city. Within the year, it'll be gone. Vulcan has purchased the property and has plans for a couple of apartment buildings there. So as a documentary filmmaker and oral historian, I decided to start recording stories with the people who work and shop at the Red Apple. I've been shopping there for 11 years, and usually it feels a lot more like a community center than a grocery store. So I want to share some little nuggets with you from some of the stories that I've been recording there.
All the friends I grew up with that lived in the neighborhood don't live there anymore. Since everyone's gone, there's nobody there. So I just mostly see people at the Red Apple grocery store.
That store is community. You know it because it's just like going to school. You see everybody there that you basically know.
It's the place where at 10 o'clock at night, you're out of milk. That's where you're going to go. It's the first place where I would allow my kids to walk to.
Her son, like you said, is autistic, so he has a hard time with a lot of stuff, you know. But for some reason, he likes pies. And he likes pumpkin pie, you know. And she goes, like you said, every day to the Red Apple, and she will buy him a pie. You know, and sometimes she doesn't have enough money, and he doesn't understand that. He just wants the pie. So she goes outside, and sometimes people give her money. Or sometimes the cashiers will complete the money, you know, or sometimes, you know, whoever, you know. Most days he gets his pie.
You know, a lot of those older people are done cooking. That's why they come in there every day.
Black-eyed peas and ham hocks and pig's feet and chitlins, greens.
Well, we get a lot of them that come and just talk to us, just want to have conversation. I think it helps them a lot, you know, because they want to be social.
I was 31, I believe. Yeah, I was 31 when I took over. And we had some white managers that were working for me. Well, they were lining up, you know, all the men would come up and line up on the other aisles and sit there and stare at the kids. And I was like, look, come here. All you guys, go to the back. Because I know if I was a kid and I were to witness that, I'm stealing. You know what I mean? If you're going to accuse me, I might as well steal. So what I ended up doing is going up there, opened up a bag of candy, and I gave every kid to walk by me a piece of candy. But at 31 years old, I'm this young cat, and a lot of my people that worked for me were older. It was tough. It was tough. It wasn't worth giving up. I just continued to, you know, just to push and treat people like people and not like criminals.
So it is a community center. It turns out the Red Apple is a place where people who've had their community torn apart go to find each other. But I've realized something else in the process of recording this story. If you imagine the Central Area like a giant constellation of interwoven stories, and the brightest stars in that constellation are where the greatest number of stories intersect, then the Red Apple is one of those bright stars. It's where a lot of stories come together and intersect. It's kind of like a portal into this constellation of neighborhood stories. I keep forgetting to show you the pictures while I'm talking. Everybody comes to the neighborhood grocery store, so this is where the stories of the neighborhood intersect in this portal into the constellation. So I created a community story project, and I called it Shelf Life. And I crawled through that portal, and I started recording stories from the neighborhood. I followed people who work and shop at the Red Apple out of the store and into their lives. and into their homes and their histories. And it turns out that their stories are really, really important right now.
We played for the Masons. We played for the YMCAs. We played for the Cabarets, the 410 Supper Club, and Black and Tan. Those were the big clubs. I didn't have to work a job. I played music. I made real money. It was actually a working community.
A lot of the local businesses, there were a number of restaurants, there were a number of barbershops, there was a record store, there was a drugstore, all local families, African-American, Asian, Chinese. We're all living in the central area. That's pretty much where we had to live. And everything you needed was in that neighborhood, practically.
Well, there was a realtor here named Hardcastle. So what he did was that he would buy the home in a block and then sell it to a minority. They go next door and tell the neighbor next door, says your value of your house is going to decrease because the black person just moved in next door. So naturally, they would sell. And they call it blockbusting. Just 111. Just pretty soon, we had that whole central area. And other real estate companies, Windermere, all those places, wouldn't even let you in the front door.
Wherever there was a Safeway, there was a Tradewell in Seattle. They were always right across, and they wouldn't hire black people. We'd go there like at 5:30, 5:45. They close at 6 and fill up dozens of carts of perishable things, roll up to the counter, and then walk out the door. Big cart full of ice cream, cheese, eggs, milk, butter, stuff that you could not let sit overnight till the next shift came in. It had to be put back right now. So that meant the staff getting off from work couldn't leave. They had to go and do it and get paid overtime and cost the store money.
And one of the things I remember about Welch's is it was really old, and it had, I remember to get down to the plumbing parts, you needed to go down 2 stairs, and I had the double stroller. So if I had to get a plumbing part, the guys would watch the twins, right? Like, they'd be like, well, we'll watch them. And that made me fall in love with this neighborhood, right? Like, oh, yeah, the hardware guys are watching the babies so I can go get my parts.
Everybody knew everybody. Like, everybody in the neighborhood would come together and someone would have something going on. It was nothing for our family to throw a barbecue on a weekend to where, you know, the whole neighborhood would eventually be there.
If it weren't for the fact that I grew up in this neighborhood, in this community, I don't think I would be the person I am today. It taught me most of everything in terms of my values and how I relate to people. I wouldn't trade it for the world.
So these stories are important because it turns out that the people who built the central area over the last 7 or 8 decades did so despite tremendous obstacles, right? Redlining, job discrimination, predatory lending, inadequate infrastructure, the daily violence of racism. These were families that had had their lives uprooted by World War II internment. These were families that had had their lives uprooted by the necessity to flee Jim Crow South. And despite all that, they managed to build and create a interdependent, self-sufficient, multiracial, tenacious, innovative neighborhood. And I think we could learn a lot from that. I think that this city could learn a lot from that. But here's this thing that we do, and when I say we, I'm speaking especially, though not exclusively, to white people like me. I think we often don't see or recognize community when it's right in front of us. And we tend to say, well, when I got here, there was nothing here. And that's what's happening to the Red Apple. Nobody looks at the Red Apple for the first time and says, oh, that's a community anchor that's keeping people alive. But it is. It is keeping people alive. And it's also a microcosm for the neighborhood, a community that for decades has kept people together and kept them alive. So when we remain ignorant of the central area's stories and histories, while simultaneously making it really hard for the people who built it to stay there, that's us again saying, there was nothing here. But the stories prove us wrong. The stories are demonstrating that there's a lot there. And they're not just proving that there's a lot there, but I think that these stories could teach us how to grow a city with room enough for everyone. Thank you.
We'll finish with playwright, naturalist, storyteller, and poet Jordan Amani Keith reading her poem, All Waters.
All Waters. Once upon a time in the long ago, not long ago. Once upon a time in the long ago, not long ago. Once upon a time in the long ago, not long ago. The people were water. Some of them were the shape of rain. Some of them were the shape of ice. Some of them were invisible. Stepping out of their robes of rain, they would sing, I enter you without leaving. I am the sound of a circle. Whom, whom, whom. I am the sound of a dream. Push, push. But they didn't know why. When the rain sang, the invisible water danced so fiercely, their feet lifted from the ground. When they rose as high as they could, they would sing, I enter you without leaving. I am the sound of a circle. I am the sound of a dream. But they didn't know why. This was their life. Every day, it was good. But one day, a complaint entered the world. The shape of ice cracked as they spoke. You people only sing and dance. You enter without leaving, but you don't know why. Do you know more than we? The shape of rain rose up, but their voice was not singing. It was getting louder. Do you know more than we? They demanded. We are the body of rain. The shape of ice did not answer at first. They held the heat of their thoughts below the surface until they began to sweat. From under the robe of ice, droplets of humans stepped out. Thousands of thousands of thousands began singing, "We are our ancestors. We are our children. We are our ancestors. We are our children." But they didn't know why. You see, long ago, memory had no form. Its hips jangled through the void. Dew gathered on its spine. Its bones hummed maroon circles. Until faces emerged from the sound, until feet stepped out of the droplets, ankles, then long bones, knees bent for marching, stomping, dancing. You see, before memory had form, we dreamed rain. Push. But we didn't know why. As the children of ice kept marching, kept stomping, kept dancing, they encircled the shape of rain and held them. Rain resisted, but the children of ice sang louder, "We are our ancestors. We are our children. We are our ancestors. We are our children. We are our ancestors. We are our children." Until very little rain was left. Suddenly, the invisible moved. am the sound of a circle. I am the sound of your dream. We are the body of water. We must not fight. But the children of ice resisted. We are our ancestors. We are our children, they sang. But they didn't know why. Then the invisible saw their feet were carbon, though they wore the robe of water. The invisible pulled off their robe of water and leapt into the air, leaving some of them as heaps of dry mountains and valleys until the invisible fell upon them. Some of them remain mountains and valleys. Some the water entered, and their robe of water became a robe of skin. Now we have memory. Now we know why. Once upon a time, long ago, not long ago. Once upon a time, we were all water. Thank you.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum featuring Ampersand Live. Again, you can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thanks again to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Tune in again soon.